a member of the 1989 Conference Committee and chairman of today's general session, Mr. William Duke.
Good morning. Is everybody getting in all right over there? All those mini hangovers from the dinner of the Counselors Academy. I can see them strangling in, right? Strangling. God, I wasn't even at that dinner, and I have my problems this morning, too. I presume that nobody by this time doesn't know that the theme for this conference is creating consensus from diversity. And if we didn't, certainly yesterday morning, Bob Teeter gave us a lot of the insight into the political diversity facing this country. But nowhere, in my view at least, is the diversity end of that equation more evident than in the international economic order. As a matter of fact, there's many of us who think that we should be calling it the disorderly international economy. Item. The reality of the new economic giants in Japan and Korea and in those other countries that we used to, in the United States, call the Far East. Item. The impending unification of the European economy in 1992. Item. The absolutely extraordinary events that have taken place in the last months in Poland and Hungary and now in East Germany. Item, the continued uncertainty regarding the economies of what we once again, from our parochial point of view, call the third world in Latin America and in Africa. There, just like every place else, I guess, everybody seems to be doing their own thing, and we don't know where it is particularly where it is going. And impacting all of that, from the point of view of us and our profession, is the reality of instant global communications, not just in stock prices and financial data, as it was maybe 5 or 6 years ago, but of political and social events and natural catastrophes that can impact your organization and mine 10 time zones in an instant. Making sense of all of this, or trying to make sense of all of this, making the effort to find the diamonds of opportunity for practitioners, trying to learn how we can help form consensus from this kind and extent of diversity is a difficult task at best. That's why PRSA is so pleased to have with us today Clyde Prestowitz, a man who has seen that diversity and experienced those difficulties firsthand. Now a senior associate for the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington, Mr. Prestowitz has served as Acting Assistant Secretary of Commerce for International Affairs. But more importantly, between 1983 and 1986, he was the principal policy advisor to the Secretary on all aspects of commercial relationships with Japan, as well as all relationships involving high tech. Now, prior to his exposure at the cabinet level, those of us who come up through the ranks really kind of like this a little bit, Mr. Prestowitz had been a Foreign Service officer, owned his own import-export firm and consulting firm, worked for the American Can Company and Scott Paper Company in international business and sales, and was for a time, isn't this marvelous, a reporter for the Honolulu Star Bulletin. Something I've always wanted to do, never could make. His book, Trading Places, How We Allow Japan to Take the Lead, was a bestseller and stimulated much thinking in this country and abroad. And he has continued to seek rationality in the international economic and business affairs through scores of articles and op-ed pieces in virtually every major national publication here and in many publications overseas. He holds a string of degrees from very impressive universities, including an MBA from the Wharton School of Finance. And as you may expect, Mr. Prestowitz is multilingual. He's fluent in what I feel is a very unlikely combination of Japanese, Dutch, German, and French. But he promises to speak to us today in English and to help us understand how we can better serve our employers and our clients in this international climate, how we might be able to find and help them seek consensus in a very diverse world. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Mr. Clyde Prestowitz.
Thank you very much, Bill. It's a pleasure to be here. This audience will appreciate, actually, my experience at the Star Bulletin. I found myself in Honolulu in the early 1960s in a situation in which I was completely out of money, and the only experience I'd had in business was as a reporter for the Wilmington Morning News during the summers in Wilmington, Delaware. So I went down to the Star Bulletin and just walked in cold off the street, went up to the editor and introduced myself and said I needed a job. And he said he didn't have any jobs, but he'd take my name. The next day he called and said that his night reporter had been in an auto accident and broken both arms and both legs, and could I come on temporarily? So I did. Well, as you all know, what cub reporters do is to write obituaries. And if you'll pardon the pun, you all know that writing obituaries is a deadly task. And so one night, I had gotten a notice from, I think it was the 31st death, and I sat down to write the obituary. And as you know, writing obituaries means you have to call the grieving widow or widower or family members. And you have to talk to these poor people at just absolutely the worst time in their lives. And I just had it. And so rather than do that, I just made it up. I said, Mr. So-and-so died after a long illness, send flowers. And the next day I went to work, and the editor called me over and he said, Clyde, have you thought about being a novelist? And I said, no, what do you mean? He said, well, that fellow that you said who died after a long illness was found in the Alawai Canal with a bullet in the back of his head. So I missed the best story of my life because I made it up. Anyhow, ever since then, I've concentrated on nonfiction. And I'll try to give you some good nonfiction this morning. What is happening in the United States, to the United States, in the new international environment, is perhaps best captured in a story that's making the rounds of Washington today. Some of you may have heard it, but for those of you who haven't, it goes like this. And President Bush is invited to give a speech to the National Association of Manufacturers. And he drives on the night of the speech to the hotel where it's to take place. And while stepping out of his limousine, he trips and hits his head on the door, and he's out cold. And in fact, he's out cold for 3.5 years. And after being reelected in a landslide, he wakes up, and he turns to John Sununu, who's been sitting at his bedside all this time, and he says, John, what happened? John says, not to worry, Mr. President, you won every electoral vote. President says, holy mackerel, I'm better off asleep than awake. And he said, well, John, what's happened to the budget deficit? And John says, no, Mr. President, no longer a budget deficit, we have a budget surplus. President is amazed. He says, well, geez, John, what about the trade deficit? John says, nope, Mr. President, we also have a trade surplus. President can't believe it. He says, John, something must be wrong. What about inflation? How much is a bottle of beer? John says, oh, that's 200 yen, Mr. President. Well, I went to Washington in the fall of 1981, and I remember going down and talking to then Secretary of Commerce Malcolm Baldrige about the position at the Commerce Department that he was offering me. And I asked him what my responsibilities would be, and Secretary Baldrige said, "Well, Clyde, your job is to reduce the trade deficit." At that time, the U.S. trade deficit overall was about $32 billion, and the U.S. trade deficit with Japan was about $9 billion. And so I asked him what my salary would be, and he said, I think it was like $40,000 at that time. And I remarked that this was considerably less than my wife and kids had become accustomed to living on. The secretary said, "Well, not to worry about that, because," he said, "the Commerce Department would pay me a bonus, 10% of the amount by which I reduced the trade deficit." And 6 years later, I owed him $6 billion. And I had to write him, I had to write a book for debt relief. I hope you all buy 6 or 7 copies. But the interesting thing is that in the fall of 1981, it was still possible, despite the Wirtschaftswunder in Germany, despite the economic miracle of Japan, it was still possible, it was still accurate to say that the United States was the world's leading country in every respect. The U.S. had the highest GNP per capita. The United States was the leader in virtually all areas of high technology. The U.S. had the highest level of industrial productivity. The United States was the world's largest creditor nation. And of course, it had the strongest military force. And today, almost exactly 8 years later, only one of those things is still true. It still, I suppose, is true that the United States has the world's strongest military force. But on every other criterion, the U.S. has fallen behind. Today, the United States is number 7 or 8 in GNP per capita, behind Japan, behind Germany, behind Belgium, Holland, Switzerland, a number of other countries. The United States is number 3 or 4 in industrial productivity, again, behind Japan and Germany, and possibly even Holland. The U.S. has lost the lead in many areas of high technology and is losing the lead in other areas. There is not a single area of high technology in which the American lead has been increased in the past 8 years. And the United States has gone from being the world's largest creditor to being not only the world's largest debtor, but being history's largest debtor. And every single day that goes by, the United States borrows approximately $500 million more dollars on the international capital markets. And so, as we sit here in the fall of 1989, 8 years after I first went to Washington, it is no longer possible to say that the United States is the world's leading country in any respect except that of pure brute military force. And the interesting thing is that we and the Soviet Union are learning a similar lesson, and that is that pure brute military force is really not all that forceful. There is not a lot that you can do as a brute military force. It's really not all that powerful. And we, the United States, are finding that we are really only competitive vis-a-vis the Soviet Union. It is only the Soviets that make us look good. Compared to the other competitors in the world, we are not doing well. We have come to the end of the American century. The Pax Americana is finished. The world is moving into the 21st century, and as it does so, a question is being posed to the United States. It's a question that this country has faced only twice before in its history, once in 1776 and once in 1860. It's an absolutely fundamental question. And the question is, what kind of a people, what kind of a nation are we going to be? Now, elsewhere in the world, there are historic dynamics taking place. In Europe, a dream is unfolding. For the better part of two centuries, Europe has dreamed of unity, never been able to achieve, except under the Romans. Europe has had high investment rates, it has had high savings rates, it has had high productivity, but it has been hampered for centuries by having small-scale markets. But sometime in the 1990s, whether it's 1992 or 1995 or 1999, I don't know. But sometime in the 1990s, Europe is going to achieve a kind of integration that it has not achieved in the past. And that will make it a formidable economic competitor. And one can feel in traveling in Europe a sense of dynamism, a sense of mission, a sense of historic purpose, which, when added to the concrete reality on the scene, makes one realize that in the 21st century, Europe is going to be a major world force with influence far beyond its borders and with tremendous influence in the United States. And in the Far East, another dream is unfolding. For the past 500 or 600 years, the nations of the Far East have struggled to catch up, to throw off the bonds of colonialism and to catch up to and equal the Western nations both economically and politically. And that's happening. And one can see not only in Japan but in Korea and Taiwan and Thailand and Singapore and Hong Kong the unfolding of that dream. For the past 150 years, these countries have focused on industrialization, on catching up technologically, on achieving leadership technologically and industrially. And they're now achieving that. And a very powerful bloc is forming in the Far East, led by Japan, cemented by Japanese finance and technology, one which will be at the forefront, the innovator in electronics, in artificial intelligence, in communications, in finance. And that entity is gaining tremendous power and influence in the United States. And again, that is the culmination of a dream. The question that is being posed to Americans today is, what kind of a dream does America have? What is the future of the United States? We talk about other countries, particularly about Japan, as being unique. Japanese always tell us that their culture is unique. And of course, that's true. And by definition, every country is unique. But in fact, the truly unique country is this country. For the better part of 200 years, the United States has been a special place. It's been a country that has offered haven and refuge. Country that has offered hope and opportunity. And the question is the United States going to be able to continue to do that? When I was writing my book, I had to spend a great deal of time in New York City. I've never been a fan of New York City, but because my editor was there, I had to spend time there. And I got to know the city somewhat, and I have to admit that New York is a great city. At one time, it must have been a fantastic place. Because today it still is a fantastic place. And yet it's living off its capital. You drive into Midtown from LaGuardia, much of the landscape looks like Bangladesh. You ride the subway, if it's working, it's worth your life to ride it. The unfunded maintenance bill of New York City is in the billions of dollars. Nobody knows how much it is. And just multiply that by Philadelphia, Detroit, Akron, St. Louis, Los Angeles. Hundreds and thousands of cities across this country. The unfunded maintenance bill of the United States is in the trillions of dollars. Or go to Washington, D.C., city where I live, capital of the most powerful nation the world has ever seen. 50%, one half of the children in Washington, D.C. will not graduate from high school. The president goes on national television and shows a bag of cocaine picked up in Lafayette Park across the street from the White House, which is telling the world that the president of the most powerful nation in the world does not control the streets across the street from the White House. Or go to the Southwest, this part of the country, Los Angeles, Phoenix. Tremendous waves of immigration into the United States. Now, in the past, we've been able to overcome these difficulties. We've been able to achieve consensus out of diversity. We've been able to bring the newcomers in, to welcome them into the mainstream of our society. We've been able to recognize our problems and to redress them. And the question that is being posed to the United States today is, will the United States continue to be the country that offers hope and haven and refuge and opportunity, or will it be some other kind of a society, a more brutal and less welcoming kind of a society? It's an absolutely fundamental question. It goes to the very nature of what kind of a people we are. It's not being posed as dramatically as it was in 1776 or in 1860. It's not a matter of war or of independence. And yet, just because it is not being posed dramatically, it is ever so much more important, more difficult to grope with, and more important that we do grope with it. The United States cannot remain the United States of history as a stumbling, declining, third-rate economic power. We discuss these issues in terms of trade deficits, budget deficits, items that make your eyes glaze over. People don't grasp the importance of a trade deficit or budget deficit. You can't pick it up, you can't look at it, you can't eat it. But it goes to the very nature of a kind of a society and a kind of people that we're going to be. People say to me sometimes, Clyde, what difference does it make? Does America have to be number one? Can America be number one in everything? Now, this is a trick question. The person who asks that question is typically an intellectual. And typically, he's not so much asking a question as making a statement. And the statement to the audience before which he asks the question is, look at me, I am a cosmopolitan. I'm an internationalist. I'm not focusing on narrow, chauvinist American interests. America doesn't have to be number one, says he, and he's daring me to disagree with him, because if I disagree with him, I've then painted myself as a chauvinist, parochial commentator. And so my response is something like this. I say, look, it's a little bit like your children. All of us have kids, and they come home with report cards. Sometimes the report cards aren't as good as you'd like them to be. Recently, my son came home and had a D in physics. I said to him, Chummy, why did you get that D in physics? Now, as you know, there are two possible answers. One is, gee, Dad, I did my best. I stayed up every night late studying. You know that physics is not my best course. Teacher is very difficult, and besides that, all the kids in my class are national merit finalists. If I believe him, that is an acceptable answer. He's done his best. I can't ask for more than his best. But the other possible answer is, well, gee, Dad, you know, I was on the football team this year, and, you know, I've been working on my new guitar, and, you know, I got that new girlfriend, and I just didn't have time. And that is not an acceptable answer. It's not acceptable to me, and I don't want it to be acceptable to him. Because fundamentally, there's something dishonest about a person or a nation that doesn't do its best. And so my response is, does America have to be number one? No, of course not. I'm as cosmopolitan as the next guy. Can America be number one in everything? I don't know, maybe not. But it has to try. Because it's the trying that affirms one's values one's belief in oneself and in the worthwhileness of what one is doing. Now, obviously, in order for us to deal with this question, the first question is, how do we get where we are? What is the problem? Why are we in this pass to which we've come? And there are many answers. I'd like to focus on three or four of them this morning. One of them has to do with the very simple economic conditions that we've established for ourselves. We have become the world's largest consumer. We're the world's poorest saver. In the United States, we subsidize consumption and we tax savings. When we buy a house, we write off the interest on our mortgage payments from our taxes. We pay a quarter for a gallon of gasoline of what the rest of the world pays for a gallon of gasoline. On the other hand, when we put money in the bank, in a savings account, earn interest on that money, we pay taxes on the interest that we earn. If you're lucky enough to own a few shares in a company and get paid dividends, we pay taxes on the dividends. We tax investment, we tax savings, and we subsidize consumption. And not surprisingly, we've become the world's greatest consumers and the world's poorest savers. And by contrast, our competitors in Japan and Germany and Korea and Taiwan do just the opposite. In Japan, when you buy a house, you don't write the interest on the mortgage off against your taxes. You go down to buy a car, you actually take some cash down to buy the car. Yeah, cash. In Japan, if you go to a department store, likely you don't buy on credit. And everybody else in the world pays $3 or $4 a gallon for a gallon of gasoline. And not surprisingly, they have high savings rates, we have low savings rates. And the importance of that is profound. The United States is, as I said, going into debt at a fantastic clip. Now, it's not just a matter of going into debt and debt having to be paid off, but as someone said recently, as a nation or as a person, you don't tend to argue very much with your banker, particularly if he's your landlord and your boss. The United States is passing sovereignty over its affairs to other countries. Every day that goes by, we're passing $500 million worth of sovereignty to international lenders in Europe and in Japan. Control over our own destiny. We're mortgaging the future of our children. All of this is a bill that is mounting that will have to be paid. And it will be paid not only in dollars and cents, but it will be paid in terms of national security, in terms of political influence, in terms of the ability of our children to continue to propagate American values. It will be more difficult for them to do that because of the profligacy of our society today. Nobody else is doing this. The Germans save, the French save, the Japanese save. Nobody else is running down their educational system. We talk about the need to improve the American educational system. Very difficult to improve your educational system when you have no money. We're the only society in the world that has seen a decline in literacy in the past 10 years. Germans aren't educating their kids less. The Japanese aren't educating their kids less. The Mexicans, the Brazilians aren't. We're the only nation that is educating its kids less today than it did 20 years ago. We talk about product quality. It's very difficult to make good quality products with worn out tools. It's very difficult to have new tools without investment, and it's difficult to have investment if there's no savings. We talk about the short-term horizon of American businessmen. It's very difficult to have a long-term horizon when you have no money to invest. That's the significance of not having any savings. Now, for a long time, we've told ourselves that our problem is a discrete problem. You know, our problem began initially in the late 1950s. We told ourselves that it was a matter of the textile industry initially. And we said, the textile industry, it's labor intensive. It's an old, mature industry. Not something that Americans should be in, we said. Let that one go to the Far East. We told ourselves, we'll find our future in high value-added manufacturing, in high technology, in sophisticated production. And then a little bit later on, we had a problem in the consumer electronics industry. First there was transistor radios, and then stereos, and then black and white TV, and then color TV. And as those industries migrated out of the United States, we said to ourselves, this was a management problem. American managers had not responded quickly enough. They'd not been fast on their feet. They'd been slow to introduce solid-state technology, we said. Besides, we said, these are labor-intensive industries with a lot of assembly, and they need dexterous Asian fingers. And again, we said, our future is in sophisticated manufacturing and high technology. Not to worry. Let those industries go. Then a little bit later on, it was the auto industry and the steel industry. Now, that hurt a little bit more because those are traditionally considered to be the core of an industrial economy. And after all, the United States was the country that put the world on wheels. But still, we said to ourselves, smokestack, rust belt. These industries are plagued by troglodyte management, Neanderthal unions. And in fact, some people even said, they deserve what they get. You know, they make poor quality products. And besides, these are old, dirty manufacturing industries. And we said to ourselves, our future is in high technology. And let the Rust Belt go. Now, at that time in the late 1970s, early 1980s, all eyes were focused on Silicon Valley, the mecca of high technology. And I remember being in Japan in the mid-1970s. The semiconductor producers of Silicon Valley dominated the world markets. They were introducing new products virtually every year. They were riding high. And not only were they the high priests of high technology, but indeed there was the thought that Silicon Valley was the forerunner of a new kind of culture in the United States, a new business culture. These were entrepreneurs. You know, they didn't wear ties and coats. And they didn't have executive parking spaces. They didn't have plush carpets in the president's office. And this was seen to be the forerunner of a new, more productive, a truly American, a truly pioneering, entrepreneurial, individualist, truly American kind of business culture that would sweep its competitors before it. And I remember some of the leaders of the semiconductor industry coming to Japan in the mid-1970s, licensing Japanese companies their technology and entering into second source agreements with Japanese producers. And I remember warning some of them and saying to them, you know, you really should be careful about how you license your technology because this country has had a program for the past 30 years to catch up with you and to surpass specifically your industry in electronics. And the response was, hey, we're from Silicon Valley, man. You know, we're not those troglodytes from Rust Belt Detroit or Pittsburgh. We're entrepreneurs. We're international. We're cosmopolitan. We're with it. We're only licensing them old technology. They'll never catch up. We're light years ahead of them. And then I went to Washington in 1981. And who do you think were the first people who came knocking on my door? Well, it was the very same gurus of Silicon Valley. And the interesting thing is that their complaints were very similar to those of the textile industry and the steel industry and the auto industry. They complained about unfair trade. They complained about dumping. They complained about inability to crack the Japanese market. It was exactly the same situation. It just happened to be a different industry. And in the years that succeeded, we have seen American dominance of the semiconductor industry drop from controlling 75% of the world market to today we're down to about 35% and falling. And we have seen the same progression in virtually all of the other high technology industries. And yet, as that happened, what did we say to ourselves? We said, our future is in services. We're going into the post-industrial age. No more dirty manufacturing for Americans. Our future is in services. Now, this is always, I have to admit, confounded me somewhat. I've never quite understood it. And a recent experience, I think, will illustrate the reason why. I was in Tokyo recently, and I had to get to the airport quickly. And for a lack of a better alternative, I took a cab. Now, those of you who know Tokyo know this is a foolish thing to do. It only cost me $200. But I had to get there, so I took a cab. Now, interestingly, the cab was clean. The door opened automatically. When I got in, the cab had white doilies on the seat. The cab driver wore white gloves. I told him to take me to the airport, and he knew exactly where it was. He spoke excellent Japanese. He even spoke a few words of English. We talked about the trade problems. We talked about the international situation. It was an interesting conversation. And then I flew into Washington National. I probably don't have to say any more, but I got a cab. Of course, it was filthy. One window was broken. It was raining. I had to sit on the other side of the seat so as not to get wet. And I told the cab driver to take me to Potomac, Maryland, where I live. Now, Potomac is not an unknown suburb of Washington, D.C. The cab driver asked me how to get there. I said, well, don't worry, I'll tell you how to get there. But it was very difficult to explain it to him because he didn't speak English. And finally, we got to my house, and I was about to step out of the cab, and he motioned me to come back because he needed a map to get back to the airport. And, you know, we say we're going to win on services. It is to laugh. If we have to compete on services, we might as well forget about it. It's not where the strength of the United States is. And we're seeing that now. We're seeing that across the board. In construction, this year, the United States is going to have something like an $8 billion trade deficit. I was at a meeting recently in Washington on trade issues, and sitting next to me was a representative from the Housing and Urban Development Department. And I turned to him and I said, how is it that you get into international affairs? I mean, after all, housing is not generally considered to be a trade issue. And he said, well, believe it or not, we're going to have a $2 billion trade deficit in housing. I said, how is that possible? You mean we're importing houses? He said, yes, prefabs. We're importing prefab houses from Europe and the Far East. We have a trade deficit in housing. In banking, we're seeing that 60% of the letters of credit for municipal bonds are being written by foreign banks. We're seeing that 11% of the banking assets of the United States today are in foreign hands and rising rapidly. We're not competitive in banking. We're not competitive in construction. We're not competitive in most of the services that we have thought were going to be our future. And so the question is it just a matter of American management? Is it a matter of one industry or a couple of industries? Obviously, it's not. Obviously, it's something that permeates our society. And to look at what those questions are, let's go beyond the question of savings and investment. Obviously, to deal with those issues, we need to have a high savings rate and we need to have a high investment rate. But there's something else beyond the macroeconomic factors going on here. First of all, let's look at the question of government policy. We tell ourselves in this country that we don't have an industrial policy, that we don't want an industrial policy. We tell ourselves that bureaucrats cannot pick winners and losers. Everybody knows in this country that bureaucrats can only pick losers. And typically when this discussion is held, it is in terms of we don't want bureaucrats picking winners and losers because bureaucrats can only pick losers. Look at Sin Fuels. Look at that white elephant. What a terrible thing it was. And there's a certain pride among Americans in thinking that it's the individual entrepreneur, the individual businessman, who is responsible for his own destiny and for achieving economic success. And if our businessmen aren't good enough, well, then too bad, we'll have to turn the markets over to foreign capital or foreign businesses. But I ask you, what are the markets, what are the industries that the United States absolutely dominates? Well, the one that comes immediately to mind is aircraft. The U.S. absolutely dominates the world aircraft industry. And why is that so? Beginning in 1917, we created the NACA, the forerunner of NASA, with the express purpose of achieving leadership for the United States in aerospace. Yesterday, while flying here on a plane, I was reading the President's Statement on National Security submitted to the Congress in 1988, one of the last documents that Ronald Reagan submitted to the Congress. And in it, he described the space program and maintaining American leadership in space as critical to our national security. Well, the United States government and its cooperation with the American aircraft industry has had a great deal to do with the fact that the United States dominates the world aircraft market. Or look at supercomputers. No question that the United States dominates the world supercomputer market. And where did that come from? It came out of the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. Or look at networks. Where did networks come from? Same place, Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. The fact is that in most of the markets where we have an unquestioned lead, we have had a great deal of industry-government cooperation. We tell ourselves that we don't have an industrial policy. It's nonsense. The Pentagon spends half of all the R&D dollars that are spent in this country. Half of all the scientists and engineers in the United States are working on defense or defense-related projects. In fact, the Commerce Department has a fish and chips policy. You've probably never heard of the fish and chips policy of the Commerce Department. Let me tell you about it. Part of the Commerce Department is the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Agency, better known as NOAA. NOAA regulates fishing in the U.S. 200-mile zone. Now, beginning about 10 years ago, a decision was made to build up the American fishing fleet. At that time, there was virtually no American fishing fleet. Most of the fish caught in American waters were caught by foreign boats. The decision was made to try to reverse that. And the way that that was done was to establish a quota on the catch of fish in U.S. waters. So each nation has a quota on the particular kind of fish that it can catch. And every quarter, the Commerce Department issues a new quota for that quarter. Any fish that Japan or Spain or Korea want beyond that quota, they have to buy over the side from American fishing boats. And every quarter, the United States reduces the quota, thereby automatically increasing the amount of fish that foreigners have to buy over the side from American boats. The result, in the last 10 years, we've built a large modern fishing fleet on the West Coast. Now, that's an industrial policy. The interesting thing is that while we were pursuing fish and chips, we were watching our semiconductor industry and our fiber optics industry and our telecommunications industry go down the tubes. So when people say the United States doesn't have an industrial policy, it's not true. The U.S. does have an industrial policy. It wants to go fishing while allowing the high technology industries to be transferred abroad. The fact of the matter is that in an industrial nation the size of the United States, it is impossible not to have an industrial policy. The tax code allocates resources. And depending on how the tax code is written, the resources can be allocated to productive uses or to non-productive uses. The result of the 1986 tax reform, which has been hailed as the establishment of a neutral tax system in the United States, is anything but. Few people realize that as a result of the 1986 tax reform, the cost of capital, that is the cost of investment, for Japanese companies in the United States was reduced, while the cost of investment for American companies in the United States was raised. Now, this was not done consciously. Nobody sat down and consciously decided that we should establish a tax code to favor Japanese investment in the United States. But the practical result of the tax reform